Dr. Bevan Martin. He's a Victoria University Maritime Law Specialist. It's a little bit about New Zealand standing up to a major trading partner and getting a result. Is that right, Bevan?
That's right. And I thought with the start of trade talks between Australia and New Zealand and the UK, respectively, for the UK's new trading relationships, it was a good one to bring up.
Now, we had you on in 2015 talking about early New Zealand maritime law, 1842 onwards, back in the days when there were lots of wrecks.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that, seem to remember that, you know, what happened with wrecks and who was liable and who got insurance and all that kind of stuff and who got paid was a big part of the whole maritime law business, wasn't it?
It was. And I'm going to move forward a few decades and for this one into the sort of 1890s, 1900 period, where things are a little bit more settled. We've got a lot more steamships starting to operate, more regular trade routes back and forth, and the New Zealand and Australian economies are starting to take off. They're starting to have a lot more, we're having a lot more exports of things like meat and dairy and fruit, which wasn't previously possible.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, I mean, what were we exporting? We exported gold.
Yes, and wool.
And wool.
Yeah, flax.
Yes. So things that weren't perishable? And well, you couldn't export perishable stuff until refrigeration came along in the 1880s.
That's right. And so our economy, the growing economy, really hit its stride in this period when, as you mentioned just before the break, the first refrigerated shipment on the Dunedin off in 1882. And that technology, of course, wasn't foolproof at the start. Took quite a lot of energy to run those, and that was going to be relying on sufficient coal supplies to keep the steam equipment going, and it had to not break down, and goodness knows if there was someone who could fix it en route. But of course, if you're carrying a whole bunch of lamb or dairy over to the UK from New Zealand or Australia and the machinery does break down, well, what arrives in London is not going to be a pretty sight.
No.
No.
It's not going to be saleable either.
Oh, no. So no. The question was, who's going to bear that loss? And it seems it could seem quite a dry question. It's sort of a contract question. You know, this we could have the same thing today. You could order something on Amazon and it arrives damaged, and who's going to pay for it? But the problem at the time was that the contracts were all very one-sided, and they all said basically anything that goes wrong, you, the cargo owner, are going to have to wear the loss.
Really?
Yes. There was very, very little that we could do about it.
Can I ask you, if that was the practice, tell me why that would have been regarded reasonable back in the prior to the 1880s. That, well, if you ship something, you don't control the shipment of it, but you've given it to somebody else, but it's still your responsibility. What's the reasoning behind that?
So the reason behind that was partly the idea that the ship owner, who was, say, sitting in London, really had no contact with their ship and no direct control over the crew or the master at the time. So there was a feeling that, and this was agreed to by both sides, there wasn't that much the owner of the ship could do. But the things that the Australians and New Zealanders thought they could do was, one, have a ship that was seaworthy to start with, and two, look after the cargo when it was stowed.
Mm.
And you got cases of things like people storing coal alongside shipments of fruit so that when the fruit arrived, it was ruined. Or another famous case of the type where they had carried a whole bunch of horses across to Australia, and then they sprayed, I think it was carbolic acid, I think, everywhere in the hold, and the meat that went in arrived tainted by this chemical. And so all the Australians were saying was, could you please at least make sure when the cargo goes in the hold that the ship's not leaking and will get to the other side of the world, and secondly, that you take some care with our cargo.
Was there any particular case that forced the issue?
There's actually lots of cases, lots of little cases. The one I mentioned with the horse treatment and the coal treatment, there's a whole group of them with names like one of the vessels called the Maori King. It was Borthwick and Eldersley Steamship Company, a whole raft of cases. And of course, if you're a cargo owner and you've had to go all the way to the courts, usually the courts in England, you're spending a lot of time and money. Even if you win, it's probably a net loss to your operation. And so the Australasians started saying, well, there has to be a better way of doing this. The British ship owners are giving us one option, take it or leave it, but we don't think it's fair that we're bearing all this responsibility.
That's interesting because we're talking about, what, the 1880s, 1890s. This is before there's an Australian Federation. There are just Australian, what, were they provinces
or colonies? A group of colonies,
yeah. And then New Zealand. We were all treated the same as far as Britain was concerned, New South Wales, New Zealand, Tasmania, whatever.
That's right. So we weren't the powerful ones in this relationship. But at the same time, we were beginning to get a lot more organised, and it's only a few years till Australia has its federation. And so as this confidence grows, the Australasians start to say, hang on, we're actually going to stand up for ourselves here. We're not this contract you keep offering us, which basically says across two pages of they've got a massive fine type not read by one shipper in 1,000 was one of the quotes from one of our locals, which we don't read the fine print now, do we, when we sign up to things. But they were saying this is unfair. And what they tried to do was they went to London and they tried to negotiate a better contract. And they sort of said, you know, this isn't a fair arrangement, but with a few tweaks here and there, we could get a fairer contract and we'd sign up to that.
Were those diplomatic representatives in New Zealand and Australian colonies, or were these individual companies?
It was really the combination of some sort of formal agents who were based in London, some who were commercial agents and some more government-focused, and then the various, they were negotiating with various ship-owning associations, and we had chambers of commerce back here in Australasia who were really trying to lead the charge. And it's one of the things that the research I did to produce this article was interesting to see how much influence those chambers of commerce had back in that period. They really were very organised law reform bodies, and they did have a lot of links into the powerful spots of London where these decisions were being made. But it didn't get anywhere. They tried the negotiation, it failed. And instead of giving up, we said, well, we're going to look at some legislation. And the United States had just, in 1893, enacted this law which said ship owners can't exclude all this liability. They have to offer a fair deal. And if they don't, it's an illegal, it's an offence. I think it was an offence you could be fined for. So it was illegal to do so. The courts would ignore those clauses in your contract. And this Harter Act, it was called, it was unsurprisingly, Mr. Harter was a congressman from Ohio, where there is a sort of inland farming interest as opposed to a coastal interest. And that legislation was reported on back here in Australia and New Zealand, and we looked at it and thought, well, that looks like a much better deal than what the British shipowners are offering us. And why don't we enact similar legislation here? So we in New Zealand, we actually moved first. And this is despite the Dunedin Chamber of Commerce, who were the main correspondents, if you like, for New Zealand. They were the ones most often involved in all these exchanges. And Sydney was the main driving force, along with Melbourne in Australia. They were actually quite timid. And every time the British ship owners said, why don't you just take the deal we're offering, Dunedin wrote and said, oh, okay, we will. And then Sydney would scold them and write another letter back saying, you can't give in, we have to stand together as the colonies. And so eventually the New Zealand Chambers of Commerce managed to convince the local parliament to pass an act emulating this American legislation, which was a major stuff you to the British ship owners, and it was followed a year later in 1904 by Australia. So they didn't copy us. I must say, you know, for our Australian listeners, they didn't copy New Zealand. We both copied the United States, which isn't how we're used to thinking of our early sort of colonial forebears. We usually think of them enthralled to the United Kingdom.
I'm imagining the British shipping company said, if we are expected to worry about being liable if the cargo we're carrying for some reason goes off, the bottom will fall out of our market. We can't do this.
Well, they certainly weren't happy about it. They really thought that I don't think the bottom could fall out of their market because they really were the only market in town. The Australians had a few ship owners from Germany and a couple of other European countries trading to Australia. We didn't, to my knowledge, here in New Zealand have much choice at all. We just had to take what we were offered. But what they did say was that it was it was hindering freedom of contract. They said there should be, you know, you and I, if I'm carrying your cargo, we should be free to negotiate a contract. The fact that I offer this contract and you have to take it because there's no one else.
That's a piece of proverbial. You're still free to choose.
Yep, that's right. You're free to choose my offer. They were really not happy to the point where they had lawyers crawling all over the New Zealand legislation and the Australian legislation back in London trying to see if it was illegal because it had breached imperial rules.
So in about 60 seconds, Martin, tell us, what was the crucial court case or decision that led to Australia and New Zealand holding sway on this?
Well, we didn't end up with a court case. We ended up with a merchant shipping conference. So they called us all together. All the Australian and New Zealand politicians went over to London. We met up and they said, look, you can't do this. You're really ruining the whole show. This is supposed to be an empire where we have a naval trade, you know, across the seas. We said, we're sisters and we stand by each other. And in the end, we ultimately won. They ultimately adopted rules across the world, which were what we were after. Took a while. It didn't happen until 1924, and a lot more countries were involved. But we did have this high water mark in 1907, where we both Australia and New Zealand stood up and said, no, this has got out of line, and we need a fairer deal. And the UK eventually had to concede that we were allowed that.
Bevan, did it encourage more exporting from New Zealand?
I don't think it ever had that much impact in practice because the economy was already going quite well in the 1880s. I'm pretty sure we had a downturn in the 1890s. Mm. So some people have said that it wasn't a particularly effective, that people at the time said it wasn't a super effective law because the British ship owners found ways around it and they were trying their best to include fine print, which would exclude it. But in terms of moving the bigger picture forward, it did have the desired effect. So individual cases, I think, didn't necessarily go in our favour, but overall, the overall narrative did, and we managed to have a good example of standing up to the big guy, and getting a much better outcome in the longer term for our exporters.
Bevan, thank you very much for joining me this evening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bevan. That's Dr. Bevan Martin, Victoria University Maritime Law Specialist.